When the rest of the crew left the bridge, Kylara noticed that Riel was still hunched stiffly over the pilot's command board. Kai levered herself out of the captain's seat, surprised at how stiff she was herself, and went across to him. He didn't look up at her.
Yes, Captain.
Any navigation hazards in the next 6 hours?
Not at present, Captain, but if those warships jump in on us...
They know our course, and we're doing what they told us to do. If they want to blow us away, they can, but they should be pursuing more reasonable tactical goals. Meanwhile, I need you rested for whatever happens later. Let Lee take over, and you go get some sleep.
Captain, I was just coming on when we left. I was swing shift watch.
Kai felt annoyed with herself. She should have known that. Too much had happened too fast, but that wasn't any excuse.
All right, then. But consider that you're first pilot, and we may need you worse later. At least consider going off at half watch.
All right.
He sat back for the first time, stretched his arms, and turned to look at her.
I never was in anything like this before, you know. I was in Space Force, yeah, but that was in a military ship. And anyway, we didn't see any action.
Most people don't. I'm just following doctrine.
Academy doctrine, taught in class. Classes where instructors sometimes reminded cadets that theory wasn't everything, that real wars had blown old theories into fragments before. And doctrine from the point of view of combatants, people who would have the big guns.
I'm glad we have you, Captain. At least you have some military experience.
Lee glanced at Riel, an apologetic look meant to soften that near accusation. Riel didn't react. Kai felt as if someone had dropped a spaceship on her shoulders in normal G, which indeed someone had. She just managed not to say it wasn't real military experience. Education isn't experience, a truth best left unsaid at the moment. Lee trusted her. That trust was good for him and for his performance, which led to good for the ship and the rest of the crew. It still felt like too much. Except that below the pressure of that trust, below the worry, the concern that would become gut-churning anxiety if she let it, was something else. Something that led directly back to the Academy, to her first days there, to the string of cadet honors she'd earned, to the ambition she'd had to be not just an officer, but a good officer. Not just a ship commander, but a good, even an outstanding ship commander. Becoming captain of Glenis Jones had reawakened it to some degree, but the complexity of the business end, getting a contract, dealing with manufacturers and finance officers and so on, had blurred it, almost hidden it. Now it sprang up again. That little bright flame that had driven her to apply to the Academy in the first place. Danger ignited it, ignited her, the way nothing else could do. Deep in her heart, she too was glad the Glenis Jones had her as captain. Despite her inexperience, she was convinced that no one else could commit any more deeply to her ship's welfare. She would get them through this. She would save her ship. She would save her crew. And somehow, despite all obstacles, she would deliver those blasted tractors and harrows and combines to Belinta. She came back from that morning of euphoric dazzle to find Lee still looking at her as if he expected her to say something.
Will do, Lee. Will do.
Kai walked back to the command chair, trying to think what next, and realized that she was still in a pressure suit. So were they all. Pressure suits would not help them if the warships fired on them, and they were uncomfortable and less efficient. She smiled back at Lee, who was still looking her way.
Time to get out of these things. Captain to crew, return pressure suits to storage with routine maintenance checks. Lee, if Riel's sitting the desk, you're the one to go rest. I'm going to be moving around the ship. I'm in contact if you need me.
She hoped she was right. At some level, she knew she was. She went to her cabin, pulled off the pressure suit, and hung it in its locker, properly connected to its recharge connectors. All the readouts were normal, as they should be. Now for a walkthrough. Down the passage to the galley, where she found the new crew fixing meals for the rest of the ship. They wore their suits, but they had the sleeve cuffs undone, the gloves tabbed back. She could tell they'd already been at work here when she ordered suits stowed.
What's for dinner, Captain?
That was Lee, but they had all stiffened when she spoke.
Sorry, Captain, we just...
You're busy, I know that. What are you giving us?
Quick and hot, Quincy said. So we're using the fresh stuff and making a crunchy sorga.
A Slaughter Key favorite. Fresh vegetables chopped into a spicy sauce.
With chicken slivers and rice, nothing fancy.
Sounds good.
10 minutes, Captain.
Skeldon's expression, a mix of gratitude and admiration, made Kai uneasy.
Wanna thank you again for taking us out of Sabine.
Skeldon.
He reddened and said no more.
We're grateful, Captain Vada. We didn't know how bad it was going to get, of course, but to get not only a ride out, but with Vada.
What did she think Vada could do for her, when they had no communications and no FTL drive? Why was Vada that special to her?
Will do.
Again, it seemed to be the right thing to say. Kylara left the good smells and warmth of the galley and headed for the environmental workspace. There, she found Mitt and Ted out of their pressure suits, both busy with hand comps running simulations.
Dinner in 10 minutes.
The sim's coming along. Luckily, we'd recharged everything when we came in. We were running light crude. So 4 extra isn't putting any strain on the main cycles at all. But I don't know how many days we can squeeze out of it yet.
Whatever we'd save by not eating today isn't worth it. Tomorrow we can starve if we have to, but those perishables won't do us any good anywhere but inside us.
All right, but I should eat here.
No, you shouldn't. The new ones have put some effort into this, and we're all going to eat together like civilized folk, even if it is cramped. Your sim will run without you.
It might finish.
And so you'll see it after supper when you can't interfere with dessert.
They aren't wasting essential supplies on dessert, are they?
I have no idea. But surely one dessert won't unbalance everything. And if you think it does, we can always pull out my Aunt Grace's fruitcake.
No, we should save that for emergencies.
Kai didn't want to think of the emergency that would require them to survive on 3 of Aunt Gracie Lane's fruitcakes.
Less than 10 minutes now.
From environmental to engineering was a short walk and a single climb. Quincy and her juniors, also out of pressure suits, were poring over diagrams, schematics, holograms. A display board was covered with their lists.
Dinner in 7 minutes, troops.
Kai wondered where she'd gotten the troops from. But they looked up at her with such confidence that her heart turned over.
In the crew wreck area.
It leaves sections uncovered.
You're all linked in, as I am, and seconds from active control boards. We eat together. Less than 7 minutes, and it smelled good. At least one of our newbies can cook.
All right, we'll be there.
Gary Tobai and his crew didn't argue at all, but headed for the crew wreck area. By then, it was 5 minutes to dinner, if the newbies had their timing right. And if they didn't, a minute or two wouldn't matter. Kai followed the cargo crew up the passage, then went on as they peeled off into the loos. She went back through the galley, where the smell was even better than before.
They're starting to gather. We'll eat in the wreck area. There's just room. I'll be back in a minute or two.
Forward to her cabin, a quick touch to her hair again, and then on to the bridge.
Riel, you're linked, right?
Of course, Captain.
Well, then come to dinner. We can race each other to the bridge if we need to, but we all need to see one another's faces right now.
But leaving the bridge...
Log's running, Riel. If something goes wrong, it's my neck and not yours. It's not a suggestion.
Yes, Captain.
And get the rest of the way out of that suit. You might as well be comfortable for dinner.
A line from an ancient text, many thousands of years old, came to her. They had studied old world military history one term. The Spartans, the night before the Persians attacked at Thermopylae, had eaten well.
Yes, Captain.
Riel stood up, stripped off the pressure suit, and put it away, meticulously checking every readout and connection. Kai didn't hurry him. She used the time to check her implant's linkage to every compartment for the 50th time and look again at the long scan display. The warships had moved, of course. They would not sit there to be targets in case Sabine Prime had weapons they didn't know about. A sprinkling of Prime's little cutters lit up the screen in no particular formation that Kai could recognize. Most were coasting. The afterglow of the Ansible explosions had changed shape and color as the debris spread and cooled.
Ready, Captain.
Kai queried their mutual linkage. Live and clear.
Fine, then.
Kai led the way off the bridge. That was unorthodox. That was, if anyone complained, illegal. Someone was supposed to be on the bridge at all times. Linkages could fail. But the most important linkage was human, heart to heart. And for that, they needed one another. Kai stopped by her cabin just long enough to pick up the little candle pair her mother had insisted on including. Supposedly, it had been patterned after one from Old World, a pair of candle holders in a single-footed stand. The rec area tables had been shoved together, and someone had found or improvised an actual tablecloth and set the rather uneven-looking table with Glennis Jones's best china. The familiar red and blue-lined Vata pattern, with a little red sailing vessel in the center and the ship's name underneath. Kai set the candle pair in the center. Of course, no one lit open flames on a ship, but the safe lights set on medium flicker were lovely enough. Her crew crowded around the tables. Those who had found seats stood up. Kai looked at each face and tried to think of something to say before the silence became too awkward.
We can't let it get cold. It smells too good.
Everyone who could sat.
What are we going to do about...
Kai held up her hand.
No business at dinner. Not this dinner, anyway. Our new crew members have cooked us a good one, and I want to enjoy it. So when they've had a chance to eat a little, we can get to know them better.
Seth has a wicked sense of humor, I can tell you that much.
Kai nodded and worked her way through the excellent sorga, realizing that she had completely missed whatever meal should have preceded it in her dash to get off the planet and then off the station. The others ate more slowly, and the talk picked up around her. Seth was explaining that his sense of humor had come from his grandfather, Jandry, not his grandfather, Garlan. Lucin Lee countered with a story about her grandfather, Lee, a custom knife maker.
Chenhadri Lee?
Yes, you've heard of him.
I have one of his knives. Fine piece of work. Inherited from my dad, who got it from your grandfather. Small universe, huh?
May I see it?
The knife, sure.
Gary fished in his pocket and brought it out. Kai looked at it. A small, black-handled folding knife. It looked smoothed by time, well cared for, but nothing unusual. Lucin peered at it.
This was in his second series of blades, see? This little mark here, he wasn't entirely satisfied with the first series. Exchanged them for these when he found the owners. Did your father show you the second blade? It doesn't look as if you'd used it in a long time.
Second blade? There's no second blade, is there?
Kind of a trick.
Lucin did something Kai couldn't see, and another blade slid sideways out of the handle.
Grandfather was trapped in a collapsed building once. Big sea storm over on Westering. In the debris, he couldn't get his big folding knife out of his pocket. He couldn't get his arm to move back enough to pull it out. He had a small screwdriver and finally made a hole in his pocket so he could push the knife out forward bit by bit. When he started making knives after that, he always had what he called the escape blade. Lots of people never noticed it.
Isn't that illegal?
Some places, yes. That's why it wasn't ever advertised, and why it's not metallic. He didn't think the laws should prevent someone saving his life. And a screwdriver, he said, was a damn poor way to cut through heavy cloth. Here.
Lee handed the knife back to Gary.
Feel this ridge? Run your thumb along it the way you want the blade to go.
Gary ran the little black blade in and out several times.
I sure didn't know that was there. My dad, well... This came to me after his accident, so if he knew, he never had a chance to tell me.
So, what about you, Paro? Where are you from? What's your family like?
Westerling family, like Lucin's. Shellfish farming back in colonial days, then shellfish processing. But we were bought out by Gramlin 50 years or so ago. Our side of the family moved into transportation. Nothing to scare Vada transport, mostly ground routes from Westerling back east. I caught the spaceship bug early on, wanted to work on the ships themselves. See new worlds, all that. My father said I had to get an education first and push me into the technical end.
Good for him. It's easier to get it in one lump than piecemeal while you're working.
Agreed. I wasn't sure I wanted drives, but he said I had a good mind for it. And there'd always be ships that needed me.
As long as someone has a general background, too.
Bia and Mihar rolled their eyes.
It's important. You young people always want to specialize in high-paying fields. But if you don't have the background, you're out of luck if the ship's expert in the Blagojevich generator gets a knock on the head and you have to deal with it.
What's a Blagojevich generator?
She made it up. It's imaginary, what she calls a teaching tool.
Caleb still looked confused. Bia patted him on the shoulder.
Never mind, Cal. This is an old engineering argument, probably as old as engineering.
They have it in medicine, too.
Just trying to understand the ship.
Cal applied himself to his rice and chicken.
It's fine, Cal. They can confuse me sometimes.
That wasn't strictly true, but Cal looked like someone who needed a kind word right then. He wasn't just handsome. He had the lost puppy look that made her want to protect him. Danger signals pinged in Kai's head.
So, Cal, tell us about yourself.
From the look on Mihar's face, she had the same impulse as Kai, and it was safer for her. Kai mentally detached herself from the lost puppy and handed him over.
East Bay City. My family's nothing special, just ordinary working folks. Ma works in the hospital, fluids tech. My dad's an accountant. That's how I got into inventory control, through accounting. Accounting was boring. Inventory control, at least there's something going on. I always wanted to go into space anyway. I guess it was playing Harmon the Hero games when I was a kid. I know there's not really any evil overlord, but...
I used to play that. Customized my copy so Harmon had my face, and whoever I was mad at that week was the evil overlord. Got caught at school once playing it in class. And of course it was Professor Jesperson. And of course it was his face as the evil overlord.
What did he do?
Laughed. Oh, it was worse than getting angry. I felt like an idiot. Then the headmaster came in and asked what was going on. And Professor Jesperson erased the set and said he'd just found an illicit game player and erased it. I never did completely understand that man. But once I didn't have the game player, I managed to get top marks in that class.
My best friend and I modified our desk pack so we could chat in class. Nobody thought it was possible, so they didn't check them out every time. We'd have gotten away with it all term if another class hadn't used our room. Two kids started fiddling with the controls, and of course, they couldn't keep a secret when they found out.
Everyone had finished eating now. They all seemed relaxed, as she'd hoped. Kai caught Lucin Lee's eye.
Better clear up now. I'll get out of your way.
Yes, Captain.
The others all rose, some stacking plates and others picking up the serving dishes. Kai picked up the candle pair and switched it off.
With Captain's permission, I'd really like to get back to the bridge.
Certainly. We stretched the rags. We don't want them to snap.
Ahmat grinned, as she'd hoped, and headed up ship to the bridge.
Now, about that schedule.
It's all ready, Captain.
And I have the preliminary environmental report.
Good. Anything critical I need to see right away? I'm overtime myself. I'm turning in for 6 hours unless someone needs me.
No, like I said before dinner, we're in good shape. I have a couple of alternative models, but everything's stable. Report's on file.
Same here.
Good. We'll all think clearer after some sleep.
Back in her cabin, Kai stripped off her clothes, not too stinky, and put them into the fresher while she took a shower. She ran through the calming exercises of spheric cyclones as she dried her hair, laid out a fresh uniform, and fell into bed, only to remember that she hadn't written a log entry since she got aboard.
Ugh.
There was, of course, the recorded log, and Lee would have written up a pilot's log, but tradition and training said a captain never slept without updating the log in actual writing. At least she could do that, wrapped in a soft robe and not in a uniform. Kai pulled out the logbook, still so new, most of its pages empty, and her stylus. She piled pillows behind her and started on the day's events. When she'd finished a terse report, she looked at it a long moment before closing the logbook.
If something happens, and this is the only surviving evidence, would a reader understand it? Would he see choices I don't? Better courses of action?
Kai could see nothing but one bad option after another. She slipped the logbook and stylus into its drawer and then turned out the light. Maybe a good night's sleep would give her the wits to find a way out of this. She woke up to the sounds of a ship on in-system drive, nothing more nor less. Kai stretched, feeling the mild stiffness of muscles held too tense the day before, but rested. She sat up and looked at the chronometer.
Damn!
She should have known they'd let her sleep too long. Into uniform, teeth clean, hair brushed smooth. She came out into the passage, feeling wide awake and hungry again. In the galley, Cal Skeldon was wiping up the sink. Kai nodded to him as she checked her implant. Riel was off duty. Lee was sitting the board. Alertly, he noticed the tick at his implant.
Nothing new, Captain.
Can I fix you something, Captain?
That ingratiating smile again.
I'll just get some cereal.
Before she could reach for a bowl, he had handed her one, along with a packet of breakfast grains.
Thanks.
She turned away to open the cooler. She found a packet of berries and added them to the bowl, then took out the cream jug. He was still there, clearly ready to do anything she asked. She poured the cream onto the berries and grains and handed him the cream jug.
I have to get to the bridge.
Of course, Captain.
Kai would have a talk with Mihar. This had gone far enough. She took her breakfast up to the bridge. Lee looked up.
Were you ever planning to wake Sleeping Beauty, or were you waiting for a prince?
Gary and Quincy said to let you have at least 8 hours. Was that wrong?
No, I just didn't plan to sleep that long.
Kai sat down in the captain's seat.
Captain's on the bridge. Section firsts, if you're finished with that assignment, come on up.
She took a spoonful of berries and cream and grain.
Where are we, Lee? Anything to worry about?
The plot came up on Kai's desk.
No, Captain. We're not going to hit anything in this system. Not anything mapped, anyway. The warships have moved in on Sabine Prime. There's been an engagement of some kind with Prime Space Force, such as it is. They haven't blown the station yet, though we're far enough out it could have happened and we wouldn't have heard.
Any sign of ISC?
No down-jump markers that I can detect. If they've come in, they've come in with something small, distant, and careful. I wouldn't know yet if they had just arrived across the system, of course.
Scan lag was such a pain. It was possible to link Ansibles to scan and get an almost instantaneous scan of an entire system, but that took the Ansibles offline for other uses. Aside from that, they were limited to light speed or less. Kai finished her berries and grain, setting the bowl aside just as Gary, Mitt, and Quincy appeared.
I hope you're all as rested as I am. What have you got for me? Mitt, you first.
Current consumption, we're good for 87 days. Gary spent all the government letter of credit on supplies, is why it looks so good. Our system's designed for straight recycling of atmosphere and water. There's no design capability for onboard food generation.
We could modify some of the equipment, but we don't have seed stock. We'd have to figure out a way to purify and prepare the basic cultures.
I can't really recommend that, unless it's that or starvation.
We'll hope it's not. You, Quincy?
Well, the ship's in pretty good shape, aside from the problems we knew about already. Nothing's leaking. Nothing's coming apart under this acceleration. On the other hand, we have to consider in-system drive fuel consumption. Since we can't jump out of this system with no FTL drive, we need to be able to get back where we came from in order to get that replacement sealed unit.
Fuel consumption so far?
7%. I know that doesn't seem like a lot, but it all depends on how long this goes on.
Gary?
Load's all secure. I've been collecting the skills lists like you asked me to. Hand-painting flat pigs seems like a useless sort of thing to mention, but...
We don't know what might be useful. Let me see here. Flower painting, yes. Surf fishing with rod and reel. Once achieved a perfect score in BizX. What is that?
A game player classic. The one where you shoot little biting things that try to eat your garden plants.
And designing and hand-sewing festival costumes.
Kai couldn't think of anything more boring herself. And that was Mitt, of all people.
Pistol bow competition, what's that?
That's... you know what a crossbow is, right?
Ancient weapon, now used in sports. Sure, my brother had one. They never would let me play with it, and it disappeared about the time Hanar moved out. He used to shoot fish with it, and sometimes rabbits.
Pistol bows are much smaller. I asked Mihar about it. She says they even proposed them to Vada main office as a shipboard security weapon. They won't penetrate hulls or bulkheads, and they don't have any combustibles, so they're legal on most stations. She says they look scary to dockside thieves, and they've had much less trouble on Palatine when the outside watch carried them.
That makes sense. So, we have a pistol bow expert. How many pistol bows do we have?
For a moment, Kai imagined the glorious defense of the ship, her crew with pistol bows against real riot control weapons that could rip holes in the ship. Not a good idea.
Only the two Mihar has. Her own personal practice and competition bows.
Just as well, then. She wouldn't be tempted. Still, if Mihar could hit something with a pistol bow, she might be good with other weapons. If they happened to find any. She went on with the list. Two who could knit, and one who could crochet. One who could blow glass. Five cross-trained in another ship discipline than that on their primary papers. Nothing that immediately sparked an idea for how to get out of this mess. Nobody claimed to know how to fashion an ansible out of yarn and some extra carrots, which is what they had most of. She came to the end of the list and found her three section firsts looking at her as if they expected she'd come up with a complete answer.
Well, that's all very interesting, but I think the next step is to see if the Mackenzie folks want to talk to us. I'd like to quit using fuel to go somewhere we don't want to go, for instance. We're well out of their way, unless they plan to blow up Sabine Prime itself.
Do you think they'll answer? If they're busy fighting...
Won't know until we try. If they're too busy, they won't answer, or they'll tell us to be quiet. I'm going to suggest that we need to reserve fuel for maneuvering. Chances are they don't know we've got this much left.
Even though she had made the decision, Kai hesitated before trying to contact the mercenaries. They would be busy, probably in the middle of a fight.
If I were their commander, how would I react to the interruption from a silly little civilian cargo ship?
It would depend, really. It probably wouldn't be the first time that a civilian ship asked for further orders or wanted to change the ones it had been given. That must happen several times in operation. So there must be someone monitoring that channel, expecting ships to call in and complain or beg. What happened next would depend on the mercenary's protocol for handling such calls, and on her approach to them.
Any comm activity on Channel 17, Lee?
I logged some very faint. It wasn't for us, all we got was outwash.
So the others were contacting the mercenaries. And by their plots, they weren't being blown away instantly. That was something. Kai would have given a lot to ask the advice of experienced spacers, preferably military. Despite the air of distaste which had colored Commander Stoller's comments on mercenaries during their military law course, he had considered mercenaries true military organizations. He would know, any of them might know, what to expect in this situation. Their expertise lay impossibly far away, in time and space. She had no connection there anymore, even if the Ansibles hadn't been out. But she did, she remembered. The card that had come with the ship model from McRobert. If you ever need to let us know about something, remember that dragons breathe fire. But she wasn't a dragon, and Glenys Jones wasn't a dragon-class cruiser. Of course, Mac knew that. Mac knew, and somehow he'd given her a way to get their attention. Now she regretted the resentment that had kept her from plugging away at the mystery hidden in the instructions. Some kind of recognition code, probably, if only she understood it. Not advanced communication devices. She was sure that the model wasn't a compact Ansible, for instance, but she couldn't figure why.
Captain?
Lee was pointing to the comm desk when Kai shook herself out of her thoughts. A light had come on. Incoming message.
Captain Vada, Glenys Jones.
Glenys Jones, this is the Mackenzie Military Assistance Corporation ship Victor. Does your ship have active gravity controls?
Yes. Confirm active gravity controls.
A long wait. Minutes crawled past, each seeming years long, before a reply came through. Unboosted communication, then.
Glenys Jones, cease boost. Say again, cease boost. Transmit cargo manifest, personnel manifest, vessel's operational status on this channel within one standard hour. Crew personal effects need not be enumerated, but all weapons must be listed. Personnel manifest to include full name, state of origin, current citizenship, age, sex, occupation. Operational status to include system status. Prepare for inspection. Acknowledge.
They're gonna board us?
Kai was glad someone else had voiced that fear. Easier to be calm when she had someone else to be calm for.
Maybe, maybe not. They might just do an external inspection.
What can we do?
Right now, what we're told. Cut the boost. We wanted to do that anyway. We can't fight, we can't run, and it won't do us any good to argue.
She thumbed the transmitter.
Glenys Jones acknowledges. Cut boost to 0XL, cargo and crew manifest, and ship operational status to be transmitted this channel within 1 hour.
No immediate answer, of course. She looked at long scan again. There. One of the warship's icons appeared next to one of the larger merchanters.
Gary, I need the cargo manifest and an annotated crew list, including our four newbies. And check if anyone has anything a military boarding team might consider a weapon.
A good team could consider a pillow a weapon.
Be serious. The kind of thing they'll be upset about if we don't declare it. Firearms, knives, that kind of thing. Vata Transport, like Slaughter Key generally, had a relaxed attitude toward personal weapons. Crew were not supposed to take weapons off the ship onto foreign soil, which included orbital stations, but they could have anything on board which fit into their personal space.
10 minutes.
Kai turned to Quincy. You heard them. I need whatever they will consider relevant operational status.
Right. 15 minutes. I need to be sure I list all the wards.
The lists, when completed, came to Kai. She looked them over. A sad little list, it seemed now. A crew of seeming non-entities, all from Slaughter Key, with a boring utilitarian cargo, on a ship that could serve as a textbook example of antiquated, inefficient, and scrapworthy. Weapons included Mihar's 2 pistol bows, 23 personal knives, mostly small folding pocket knives like Gary's, and 9 kitchen knives, from paring to chopping. Kai wondered about that. The mercenaries hadn't said to include kitchen cutlery in the list, but the big butcher knife would certainly kill someone. She sent the lists off in good time and turned on the intercom.
We've received communication from Mackenzie. As some of you already know, on their orders, we have cut acceleration and sent off cargo and crew manifest. They said prepare for inspection, so I expect that when they get around to it, they'll come out here and look us over. They may board the ship to check our actual cargo against the manifest. Keep in mind that they have guns and we don't. We will comply with their orders until further notice.
Kai wondered if she should have included the last 3 words.
If any of you have any personal weapons which you failed to tell your section head about, do it immediately. I can think of few things that would anger a military commander more than finding concealed weapons.
An hour later, she got her answer from the mercenaries.
Folding knives under 6 centimeters in length are of no concern, nor is kitchen cutlery. You will receive specific instructions for inspection.
Riel had relieved Lee, and they had all eaten a sketchy meal, when the icon of a Mackenzie warship appeared only a few 100 kilometers away. Near scan showed a mass proximity warning as the comm desk lit again. Kai nodded to Riel, who damped the warning siren.
Glynis Jones, acknowledge.
Glynis Jones, this is Captain Vada.
This is Mackenzie ship Victor. We will be doing an exterior inspection prior to boarding. Lock down your controls. We don't want accidents.
Kai nodded to Riel, who pulled the safety cover over the controls and latched it.
Controls locked.
Describe your personnel vacuum lock.
It's an emergency escape lock that provides access to an escape passage leading from the stern to crew quarters. Capacity is 4.
Kai added the schematics to her voice message.
How old is that tub anyway? That design's ancient.
Keel laid 87 years ago. Refits in 04 and 38. Last drive replacement in 43.
What's your normal personnel access?
The dockside forward, but it only opens to equal pressure within a few millibars.
All right, here's what you're going to do. We do our exterior inspection. Meantime, get your crew assembled. Do you even have a space big enough?
Crew wreck. Just barely.
Fine. Get them in there except for bridge watch. You can have 1 comm tech. Do you have a comm tech?
Not separately, no sir.
Well, someone to handle communications and your pilot on watch. They're to sit quiet, hands off the controls, and wait. The rest of the crew, unlock personnel lockers for inspection, unlock all hatches, drawers, everything. But all personal weapons except small pocket knives in the galley. You do have a galley, right? You listed kitchen cutlery.
We have a galley, yes.
Lay out all the weapons in the galley. Unlock but leave closed the food storage units. Now, your cargo holds are aired up or vacuum?
Aired up.
Are your cargo loading hatches vacuum capable?
Only one of them, and they're small compared to modern ships.
Huh. Our exterior scans are showing that, and you claim your FTL drive is non-functional. About time to scrap that old crock.
Not now. Not right this moment with them inside of it.
Now, for you. I am speaking to Captain K. Vata, right?
Cold sweat ran down Kai's backbone.
Yes.
You will proceed alone down the escape passage to the lock. You will not wear protective gear. You will tab in on the hardwire ship comm and wait for the signal from the boarding party. The code IDing our boarding party will be Blackfish. You will operate the lock for our boarding personnel. Following their entrance, you will obey the orders of their commanding officer. If you disobey, your ship is toast. Got that?
Yes. Operate the exterior lock for your boarding party, alone, not in pressure suit.
Good. You have approximately 20 minutes to prepare for inspection.
Kai sat back. Always breathe, her academy instructors had said. What they hadn't said was what to do after that breath, when you were stuck in a ship with no options. She addressed the crew again, repeating the instructions she'd been given. She could feel the same fear seeping along the corridor out of the bulkheads that she herself felt.
Who should sit the comm desk? Who's the most level-headed? Quincy? Gary? Mitt?
They were the most experienced, but she needed them to keep their section steady. Certainly not one of the newcomers, whose steadiness she didn't know. She called Quincy separately.
I need a calm person to sit the comm desk. I'm supposed to wait near the emergency lock to cycle the boarding party in.
Not alone.
Yes, alone. That was specified. Just find me a comm watch person, Quincy. We're going to try to get through this without casualties.
If it was possible. If they didn't plan to blow the ship after taking off everything of value. She turned to Riel.
You're officially second in command, Riel. I'm leaving you on the bridge. Use your best judgment if something happens to me.
I don't know. I never expected...
None of us did. Suck it up, Riel. This isn't a game. You're on deck.
Kai couldn't believe she was the one talking to him like this. She was younger, less experienced.
You're not scared.
Scared or not scared isn't the issue. You know that. It's doing the job. You're trained. You've got the experience. You'll do it. And after all, the most likely thing to happen is that they look us over and decide we're insignificant.
What if they're grabbing people, hostages or recruits or whatever?
Kai spread her hands.
I can't stop them, Riel. But I don't expect they will, not on a campaign.
She should think of something for him to do, something to occupy his mind, but nothing occurred to her and she couldn't take the time.
You'll do fine.
She stopped by her cabin to use the toilet and straighten her hair. If she was going to meet these mercenaries, she was not going to look like a rat pulled out of a drain. She made sure that her stowage compartments were unlocked and then moved quickly through the ship, past crew who were coming to the wreck area, and made her own check of locks as quickly as she could. No time to inspect contents, but at least she could see for herself that lockers had been unlocked. The hatch to the emergency escape passage, never locked, opened away from her. The passage lights came on as she entered and began pulsing in sequence, intended to guide escapees in the right direction, but annoying now. She didn't have time to worry about overriding the automatics. Ahead, the small bay just inside the vacuum lock glowed with warm colors from the amber and red outlining the lock's inner hatch. Kai plugged the cord of the wall-hung exterior comm unit to her earbud and waited. She had ample time to review the instructions for manual operation of the lock, which were shown in print and illustration both, on the bulkhead next to the comm unit, and to look at the empty cubicle of the lock itself, shown on the monitor from the vidcam inside.
Glennis Jones! Blackfish! Blackfish, open up!
Captain Vada here. Initiating outer hatch opening.
Armored figures moved into the lock interior. Behind them, something thin and glistening stretched into the dark. Kai stared at the monitor. Dark armor, streaked with thin lines of metallic paint in a spare abstract pattern, hung with bulges that must be equipment. Very obvious weapons.
Close outer lock!
Closing outer lock!
One of the figures reached back, grabbed the inside push bar, and yanked.
Pressuring up! Opening interlock.
The hatch opened into the lock. Kai stepped back against the bulkhead to let the invaders out. The first in line faced her and kept a weapon pointed at her. Kai stood still, hoping they couldn't detect her pounding heart. But they probably could, if those suits had the capability of Slaughter Keys combat suits. The second pulled the interlock shut, then moved a short way down the passage.
You're Captain Vada?
The voice came through her earbud. She didn't know if the speaker was in the suit or still outside.
Yes.
Kind of. Young, aren't you? Are they robbing cradles these days?
Kai was not going to rise to that bait.
First voyage. It was supposed to be a milk run.
Lucky you. I suppose we should be glad you had the sense not to play hero. Tell me, is your entire crew straight out of infant school, or is there someone aboard with a gray hair or two?
Kai refrained from saying that they had the crew list.
Most of them are older than I am.
Caretakers?
Something like that.
Kai thought of making the comparison with senior NCOs and young officers, but thought better of it.
You don't get upset easily, do you?
Kai wasn't sure what the right answer to that one was.
I try not to.
Well, suppose you cycle another round in, then.
Kai worked the controls, and the next two entered.
Unplug from the phone. I'm switching to external speakers. We'll handle the lock from here. Start back up the passage. We're right behind you. Don't try anything.
Kai could think of nothing to try. She led the mercenaries up through the escape passage, trying to move calmly, trying not to think about those dangerous figures behind her, their weapons pointed at her. After all, if they'd wanted to shoot her, they could have done that right away. And if they'd wanted to blow the ship, they could have done that too. Whatever it was they wanted, so far, it included keeping her alive and the ship in one piece. Gerard Vada, pacing his office, waited through the noises and delays involved in placing an intersystem call. He could imagine all too clearly the distances a signal must travel to Interstellar Communications headquarters, the light years from Slaughter Keys system to the relay at Beckwith Star, more light years from Beckwith Star to Nexus 2, and from Nexus 2 to Nexus 1. More light years than his age. Finally, the open line. But now he had to convince layers of underlings whose jobs depended on keeping the officers of ISC insulated from people like him that this time they should instead let his call go through. He had one in. Vata Transport had been a steady supporter of ISC over the years when other long-haul shippers had argued for laws restricting ISC's monopoly. Louis Parmina, now only 3 slots away from the CEO ship, and rumored to be the chosen successor to the current CEO, had been a Vata guest more than once at Corley. He kept his voice pleasant and firm, pushing down the impulse to scream at Parmina's personal assistant, who, when he finally got through to her, wanted him to call back the next day at 3 p.m. local time. He repeated again that the matter was urgent, and the setup time for an intersystem call made it impossible to be that precise.
Oh, are you calling from out-system, then?
He had explained that more than once at every level.
Yes, I am. This call originates in Slaughter Key, approximately 187 light-years away, through 2 intermediate relays.
Oh, well, I'll see if Mr. Parmina can speak with you. He is a very busy man.
It seemed a year, but was, by the chronometer on the wall, less than 90 seconds before Parmina spoke.
Gerard Vada. It's been too long, Gerard, since I was out your way. What can Interstellar do for you?
Gerard knew he should respond with some pleasantry, but it was the middle of the night here in Slaughter Key's capital city, and he was grumpy with exhaustion.
You've lost Ansibles at Sabine Prime. My daughter's there.
With the Slaughter Key Space Force? What are they doing in Sabine?
Clearly, Parmina had kept up with the Vada family, at least enough to know that Kai should by now have been a commissioned Space Force officer.
No, as a Vada transport captain. The military thing didn't work out.
Oh, I'm sorry. But your delightful daughter, not really the military sort, was she?
Somehow it was worse that someone outside the family would have predicted Kai's failure. Gerard pushed that aside.
No, but the thing is, something bad must be happening in Sabine system. We don't have any ships in the area. Kai's in there with an old tub that was on its last legs. She was taking it on its last voyage to salvage.
Never mind that she wasn't supposed to be in Sabine anyway. That was family business.
And I was wondering...
I understand your concern. As a father, if that were my daughter, I'd be frantic. I hope you'll understand that I cannot comment at all on what ISC thinks about this, what course of action, if any, the company might choose to take. Encryption is all very well, but...
I know that. I don't expect that. What I wanted to ask was, in the event that ISC finds out something about, well, about Kai, is it possible you could let me know? I know it's probably against policy, but, well...
Jerry, right now I can assure you that we have no information on anything in Sabine's system. All we know is what you know. The Ansibles went down in a catastrophic way. In the event that we reestablish communication, our first priority has to be restoring service. But yes, if we happen to find out anything about your daughter, I will do my best to see that it's routed to you. It's irregular, but you've been a long-time supporter, and I know how I'd feel if it were my daughter.
Thanks. I owe you. And how is Denise doing at Sylvina?
Well, she's making good grades, finally. But she's changed her major 3 times in the last 2 years. If I understand their transcript system, the courses she'd passed might qualify her for assistant gerbil trainer in a zoo. Why is it, Jerry, that daughters invariably go after something either impractical or unsuited to their character? All my sons went straight into business, but Denise? It's like she has a magnetic repulsion to anything that would do her some good.
This begged for a similarly condescending comment about Kai, but Gerard could not make himself tell about Kai's expulsion, not while she was in danger, if she was even still alive.
Daughters, you're right about them.
I'll do what I can, Jerry, but I can't promise anything, you understand that?
I do, and thanks again. I appreciate your willingness to even listen to me.
Always. And the next time I'm out your way, I'll be sure and stop by.
Gerard turned off his desk unit and turned to face the window. Out there, the city lights, like stars. And somewhere, his daughter. In here, the darkness and the waiting.
I hate waiting.
The sound of his voice startled him. Time to go back to his city apartment and try to sleep. Tomorrow, he was supposed to fly back to Corley and host the annual estate picnic. He wanted to commandeer the fastest courier ship Vada had and go find out if Kai was all right. The ISC repair ship Cosmos, routinely assigned responsibility for Ansible maintenance in Sector 5, 23 systems of which Sabine was one, had received the company's current upload on military security. Every military organization known to be operating in Sector 5 with its current, or believed to be current, location and mission. ISC agents stationed on Ansible platforms reported daily on military activity, among other things, which enabled repair ships like Cosmos to know what they might be getting into when they came to repair an Ansible that went offline. Jed Sinclair, senior analyst aboard the Cosmos, looked over the updates. 3 such organizations had relevant notations and had not shown up on any Ansible listing since the Sabine Ansibles went out. Barclays Best, a fairly new organization, had taken its entire fleet and personnel into jump space from Matlock 17 days before the Sabine Ansibles went out. They had 3 mapped jump points from Sabine, though military vessels often used odd, indirect routes. Mackenzie Military Assistance Corporation had dispatched 2 cruisers from its home base on Knifecroft. They jumped out of their system 8 days before the Sabine Ansibles went out. Gruen Colonies Incorporated had sent 3 ships out 11 days before the Sabine Ansibles went out. Jed thought about that. Gruen could almost certainly be taken off the list. Gruen used its security forces to put down riots and rebellion in its colonies. It had never, so far, attacked anyone else. Barclays and Mackenzie were both straight-up mercenary forces, for hire to anyone. Worst case, they were both at Sabine. He didn't believe worst case. ISC's tap on the financial Ansible, which gave him information on funds transfers into and out of the system, suggested that Secundus didn't have the resources to hire 2 different mercenary companies.
So, which is it? What difference does it make?
He was pondering when new data popped up on his screen. Barclays had shown up on the Timodia Ansible, apparently involved in the dispute over ownership of some uninhabitable but mineral-rich minor worlds.
Mackenzie.
They had a profile, and that profile did not include blowing up Ansibles. Interesting. ISC had fought some bloody engagements to convince everyone, planetary governments, system unions, space militias, and mercenaries, that Ansibles were not target opportunities. They had an unwritten but generally known policy that allowed combatants to fight over control of communications without actually damaging the Ansibles or their platforms, with ISC committing to cooperation with the victor. Mackenzie had acted correctly, from ISC's point of view, in other wars it had fought. In fact, Mackenzie had an acceptable rating on a scale where there were only 2 values and a large, wide, deadly line between them.
So did Mackenzie blow the Ansibles or someone else to downgrade Mackenzie, or simply to get ISC attention? And what'll happen if Cosmos jumps into the system and starts working on replacement Ansibles?
Jed forwarded his conclusions to the Cosmos captain and back to headquarters. Then he downloaded all the data ISC had on the Sabine system and started looking for a sneaky way in. Master Sergeant Callie Ray Pitt, 28-year Mackenzie veteran and fireteam leader for the boarding party assigned to Glennis Jones, had loaded the traitor's crew stats into her implant. As always, the most dangerous time came first, when they had to depend on a civilian ship captain to be smart and steady. Most were. A few weren't. A few panicked right at the moment of boarding and tried something stupid. And although Mackenzie personnel were willing to blow away difficult, neutral civilians, it was bad for business. So she always hoped that civilians would behave like good little civs, not get in the way, follow orders. Glennis Jones, on exterior inspection, looked like the old tub she was, an antiquated and inefficient design decked out in the colors of a famous and very respectable trading firm. Callie had seen Vada ships before, rotund, well-kept ships with neatly uniformed crew guarding the docking access. Not as good as military, by a light year or so, but certainly a quality organization, as civ organizations went.
So why are Vada keeping this old scow? And why is it captained by a Vada family member?
A very, very young Vada family member, in fact. Callie watched the young Vada captain carefully. The crew stats had told her age, which she'd assumed was a mistake until she saw the woman's face. A young face. A young person's racing but steady heartbeat. A young person's lung capacity. Her suit picked up the woman's vital signs easily, as it would have detected the residual effects of longevity treatment. The woman was actually that young, and a captain of a seriously deficient little ship. And not nearly scared enough.
What does she know that she isn't panicking?
She should be terrified by the proximity of large, threatening, armed and armored soldiers, faceless. Callie knew the woman couldn't see through the visor. She was scared, but she wasn't panicked. Callie tried to push her, teasing her about her age. The woman didn't budge, emotionally. That said something. Few young civs had that kind of emotional discipline.
Callie, talk to me. What's happening?
That was Sid back on Victor. They'd have a recorder running. She had the little eye blink on her helmet. They'd see what she saw and hear what she heard. But Sid wanted her analysis as well, at least when nothing was, thankfully, happening.
The captain's young, and there's something... She's not reacting like I expected.
Trouble?
None yet. She's done everything I told her to, but I don't know.
Bad feeling?
Not really, just don't understand something about her.
Go on, then. We're on the ticker.
They were on the ticker, indeed. Some idiot, possibly their employers and possibly someone else, had blown both Ansibles in this system, and ISC would be crawling all over this place sometime soon. Nobody wanted trouble with ISC.
God's grant they don't blame Mackenzie.
They really, truly needed to let ISC know they hadn't done it. They really, truly needed to know who had long-range missiles like that and the will to use them and how many were left. Meanwhile, she was stuck in the narrow emergency evacuation passage of a ship older than her own grandmother, real time, following a captain who looked like a schoolgirl in Mama's uniform. And if there was anything on this ship worth confiscating, she'd be very much surprised. With a schoolgirl captain, a girl whose every expression, every movement, communicated habitual honesty, if they said they had a holdful of tractors and cultivators and combines, they probably had exactly that. She did not believe, however, that their FTL drive sealed unit was really totally blown. Not unless this fresh-faced schoolgirl was the family disgrace, and they'd sent her off in a derelict, hoping it would come apart somewhere in jump space and rid them of a problem. She shook her head mentally. Shaking her head inside the suit would create problems she didn't want, at the memory of that face. First off, Vada Transport didn't have that kind of reputation. She'd shared drinks with some Vada crew when they were on the same station. Vada would fire incompetence, sure, any company would. Vada kids who weren't good on ships were put to work on planet. That was typical, too. They weren't going to risk their profit margin by letting the bad eggs handle ships. But Vada took care of its own. They wouldn't send a whole crew off to die just to rid themselves of a disgrace.
Besides, how could a nice girl like that be the family black sheep?
Callie had long experience of family disgraces, male and female. At least 2/3 of the applicants for Mackenzie were family disgraces. Sex, intoxicant addiction, dishonesty, theft, legal problems. This Vada girl didn't fit the profile. What it looked like, given the crew profile, was exactly what the girl had said. Supposed to be a milk run. New captain, experienced crew, see how she does. Get all the new captain jitters out of her. Meanwhile, not wasting an experienced captain's time taking this wreck to the junkyard. Next time out, she'd have a real ship. Probably do a good job with it, for a sieve. Her bad luck at war caught up with her. But, given no problems, she'd be out of this in a month or so, heart whole and unscarred. Mackenzie had no quarrel with Vada Transport. Mackenzie wanted no quarrel with Vada Transport. Mackenzie wanted no quarrel with anyone, just a straight contract and good credit. And if there were problems, she would die. That nice girl, that daughter of the family, with the experienced crew and the old tub of a ship. Callie thought of her own daughters, all but one safely far away on a world at peace, with steady jobs, and the one safely dead, victim of random violence when Callie'd been off on a mission. There was always that possibility, for parents and for children, and Callie was mindful of it, as someone who had survived the years from recruit to master sergeant must be. Ahead of her, the captain's trim back moved through the escape access hatch into the ship's regular passage, blessedly wider, and then toward the wreck area, where the crew had been told to assemble.
Tell him to sit down on the deck, hands on knees.
The Vada captain's voice didn't shake as she gave the order, even though her biostats were still showing elevated pulse and respiration. As Callie came into the wreck room, the suit's chem sniffer picked up aromatics it labeled fear. A lot of them, from a lot of people. She did a quick count, coming up one short.
Where's Skeldon?
Callie's suit picked up the name, displayed a visual, and a note from the crew manifest. Caleb Skeldon, age 24, standard, sex male, height 197 centimeters, handsome as a story cube hero. Definitely possible trouble. The suit labeled him threat.
He was here a second ago.
Gary Tobai. The suit matched face to crew manifest. Age 74, sex male, loadmaster, expression worried. No chem scent of aggression, not a threat.
I turned around when you said to sit down. He was right behind me.
The captain's chem scent shifted from fear to anger. The suit's analysis shifted her icon from no threat to possible threat.
Blast it all! What's he think he's doing? Skeldon, get back in here and sit down.
No answer. Callie boosted the suit's sensors. Down the passage to port, in some compartment. It would be below the captain's hearing, but that didn't mean she didn't know. She could have set this up, or Skeldon could just be young and stupid. The rest of her team was aboard, 8 of them in all. Gil, back at the lock, just in case.
Jeff, cover these. Mitch, Grady, Sheila, come with me. You're gonna lead us to the bridge, Captain, and I suggest you convince your crewman to surrender himself.
Skeldon!
No answer. From the way the others had obeyed her, it wasn't that she was slack.
Go on.
The captain edged past the close-packed sitters to the passage beyond. Callie followed, weapon ready.
How long has Skeldon been on your crew?
A few days. 4 slaughter key spacers were stranded. The embassy asked us to get them out. He's the youngest.
That made sense. New crew, not yet used to this captain, and the right age to think he should be a hero. Though if the captain had tried to plan an ambush, he was the sort she'd use.
Do you have a weapon?
Not that he declared. But then he didn't tell me he wasn't going to follow orders either.
The back of her neck had reddened. She was a hot reactor then. Flushed up when she got angry suddenly. Whoever that was, Skeldon for a bet, was in a compartment to port. When she boosted the IR sensitivity, she could see the hot footprints going in the hatch ahead of them, none coming back out.
What's the next compartment port side? On the left.
The suit didn't show any hesitation, any telltales of recognition or readiness in the captain's posture or movement.
My cabin. Bridge is just ahead on the right.
Stop.
The captain stopped and did not turn around. Another surprise. Most civs did automatically turn to face the person they were talking with.
Where could Skeldon go from where he was, without our seeing?
The galley, my cabin, the bridge. There's a maintenance passage, that next hatch on the left. It's the fast way aft,
past crew quarters to the hold control nexus.
And where do you think he went?
Maintenance passage would be my guess. If he's scared, trying to hide. The holds are aired up. He might try to get in there and hide. If he went to the bridge, Quincy'd send him back, but I can check. Quincy, did Skeldon come onto the bridge?
No, Captain. Is everything all right?
No. He skedaddled from the wreck area, and the boarding party wants him back.
Can we turn the bridge monitors back on? We could find...
No live scan.
Live scan could give information as well as receive it.
What about your cabin, Captain?
This time, the captain did turn around.
My cabin? Why would he? It's off limits to crew anyway, and there's no place to hide in there. It's a dead end.
All Callie's experience told her the captain wasn't lying. But the hot footprints went into the captain's cabin. Protocol was, the ship's captain led the way everywhere they went at first, and took the first shot if things went wrong. Protocol kept them alive, had kept her alive for 28 years, and she didn't plan to die until enjoying a long and luxurious retirement. This captain didn't deserve what was going to happen, but life wasn't about what people deserved.
Well then, let's go check out your cabin. Need to see your logbook. We'll deal with your crewman next. He's in the captain's cabin. She may not know it. We'll take him down as protocol. She's mine, Grady. He's yours.
Protocol didn't require killing her. Callie would make that decision as the action unfolded. The captain still had that slightly furrowed brow. Not the dramatic furrows that meant acting, fake confusion, but the slight wrinkle of real thought. The flush of annoyance had faded, typical of the type, quick anger and quick recovery. She turned and went on up the passage, Callie right behind her, stepping on those hot footprints like she couldn't see them, which she couldn't if she didn't have IR boost implanted somewhere. Grady moved up beside Callie. As the captain slowed to turn into her cabin, Grady took a long step past her. The captain hesitated, glancing that way.
Go on.
The captain shrugged and stepped into her cabin. Her head swung to the left as something caught her eye. If she'd known, she would have looked straight or to the other side. Callie had just time for that thought before the wild-eyed young hero leaped forward, shoving the captain aside and aiming a ridiculous little punk pistol at Callie. The round bounced off of her helmet, even as Grady brought up the riot needler. The captain was in the line of fire. Callie's arm swung out reflexively. Callie's swing at the captain connected too late. The suit's augmented strength gave it the force to fling the captain across the cabin into a locker. The captain lay still.
Jeff, keep him quiet. Keep him there. Skeldon attacked with a firearm. I don't think they knew he had it. He's dead. Captain's injured. We'll render first aid. Sheila, secure the bridge crew.
First thing, keep order. Next thing, find out if they had one deader or two. Her suit said the captain had pulse and respiration, pressure dropping. Callie called up the med subroutines and moved across the bloody deck. That carpet was going to be harder to clean than proper tiles, to the captain's unmoving, crumpled form. Experience helped. The small-caliber, low-velocity penetration of the damped pistol round in the arm, first aid stuff, painful but not dangerous, need some rehab, nothing too difficult. IR scan showed heat already in an ankle, probably a sprain, trivial. Head or spinal cord injury was the worst possibility. She'd meant to knock the captain out of the way as gently as possible, but her crewman's shove had created movement sums that flung her too fast the wrong way, and she needed her helmet off to find out more. The way she was lying, it could be a broken neck, but the young sometimes had very flexible necks. Best not to move her. Best to call a real medic.
Pitt to Victor.
What's up, Pitt?
Need a medic. Possible C-spine injury, not ours. Captain of this tub.
Just finish her, why don't you? We're in a bind. We don't have time to play nursemaid to sieves.
Because she's young and maybe dumb, but not bad.
My call. Send me a medic. The captain's injured. I've called for a medical team. I'll talk to the rest of the crew. We'll want to clean up this mess.
The mess that had been a handsome blonde youngster who thought, for some reason, a punk pistol, a spacer's bar special, would stand up to military-grade armor and weaponry. He'd probably had a crush on the captain or something. He'd wanted to show off. He'd wanted to protect her. And because of him, she was lying there with a hole in her arm, and maybe gorked as well. Callie had her own opinion of young men, having trained a goodly number. Young women could be just as stupid, but unless children were involved, they rarely indulged in gratuitous heroics. Gratuitous back biting was another thing. She clambered up from her examination.
Live, damn it.
Vada's War, Trading in Danger is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2003, Elizabeth Moon. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Jonathan Watkins, Christopher Graybill, Barbara Pinellini, Thomas Penny, Tim Getman, Andy Clements, Lily Beacon, Michael Glenn, Stephen Carpenter, Terrence Aselford, Michael John Casey, James Lewis, Mort Shelby, Ken Jackson, Lily David, Sonny Lasky, Joe Brack, Dylan Lynch, Richard Rowan, Tom Simpson, Tim Carlin, Casey Platt, and Colleen Delaney. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Chris Rowan and Nathaniel Perry. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan. Book adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Ferrier. If you enjoyed Vada's War, be sure to look for Rogue Angel, available at Rogue Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net.
What is your name?
Anya Creed.
I see.
Who are you?
My name is Agamemnon. We have your passport here.
They took it from me when I was kidnapped.
We will videotape your beheading and then broadcast it all over the world.
Beheading?
Are you afraid to die?
I faced death before.
I will kill you!
Don't move. Who are you?
My name is Anya Creed. The Abu Sayyaf kidnapped me several days ago. I have no idea where I am.
You live here, or are you just passing through?
Gunnery Sergeant Vic Gutierrez, United States Marine Corps.
Something bothering you, Vic?
I got this feeling like someone's keeping an eye on us.
Excuse me!
What happened?
Anya, wake up and pay attention.
Where are we?
You are in a cavern located far beneath the surface of the jungle. You're wasting your time. You would need to be a lot stronger than you are in order to break free. Besides, you are to be sacrificed to our god.
I don't believe you.
Very well. You believe now, don't you?
Oh, great.
Oh, crap.
Rogue Angel 18. Sacrifice. In graphic audio. If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.